Okay, hi, and welcome back to the Fatigue Super Conference. I'm Claire, the head of research at the Optimum Health Clinic. And this morning, I'm so excited to be talking to a good friend of the clinic, Laura Sterling, about the different types of functional tests for fatigue clients. So Laura herself is a registered nutritional therapist with over 12 years in practice. She's also a certified functional medicine practitioner with the IFM. And after dealing with her own illness in the early 2000s, Laura made dietary and lifestyle changes to successfully restore her own health. Laura has spent the past 12 years working for specialist diagnostic laboratories. She has a huge passion for learning and keeps up to date with lab testing developments, as well as her own understanding of biochemistry, and conveys these in a practical manner to practitioners and doctors. She's a valued speaker at nutritional colleges, universities and conferences, and enjoys educating practitioners. She's a founding member of the AFMMP, the Applied Functional Medicine Mentoring Program, which provides unbiased and industry-leading education and focuses on building a strong community of allied healthcare practitioners and to collaborate in reducing the burden of the chronic disease epidemic. So Laura, welcome to the conference and thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. So before we dive into a discussion about some of the tests we might use to assess fatigue, perhaps you could explain to the audience, what's the difference between functional testing and standard NHS testing?
It's a great question to start off with. So the NHS will do markers that there's a lot of data on, that have quite broad reference ranges, and that instantly pick up possibly a disease or an actual diagnosis. So let's say you're looking at thyroid, then they'll be able to diagnose you as hypothyroid or hyperthyroid based on that. Let's say you're looking for diabetes or type 2 insulin resistance with regards to something like fatigue. They've got very specialist parameters for that. Yeah. Testing in functional medicine is slightly different. So there's two differences. Firstly, in blood testing, some of the blood tests are much more thorough, much more advanced, things that have been established a little bit more recently. And so as an example there, not specific to fatigue so much, but in something like cardiovascular disease, for example, there are more advanced lipid markers, more advanced things that just haven't made it into the NHS yet. They might do. It might be about cost, really, I wonder often. But specifically to fatigue, using something like thyroid as an example, you can, there's a lot of other markers that could be, the NHS will do definitely one marker, possibly two. In functional medicine, you would broaden that to probably six or seven markers. And the reference ranges are slightly different. So there'll be very broad reference ranges on the NHS that will capture absolute disease and dysfunction. With functional medicine, you narrow those reference ranges based on huge population studies as well, but to try and pick up imbalances earlier. So it's dysfunction rather than disease, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, I guess with something like the thyroid, I think the one marker they do actually reliably use now is the TSH, the thyroid stimulating hormone, but we're not really getting something like thyroxine, T4, T3
exactly.
anymore.
And then there are also other tests that are just not even considered yet on the NHS. So for example, talking about adrenals for stress, they do have parameters to diagnose autoimmune or kind of failure of the adrenal glands or massive overstimulation of the adrenal glands. But there's nothing that looks at this kind of gray area, looking at resiliency really for the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal communication that might be off. So that's just an area looking at adrenal stress that's just not even on the radar yet within the NHS, which would be more of a functional assessment, I guess. The cortisol awakening response would be a good example of that.
Yeah, brilliant. So we'll go through some of those tests in a bit more detail later. So obviously fatigue is quite a complex condition. I mean, it sounds just like somebody's tired, but when someone's tired all the time and that they sort of lose that resilience, I guess one of the things we always discuss with you at the lab is, you know, kind of more questions, more background onto where they're at. You know, are there sort of GP tests within normal range or within the normal functional range as we sort of know of, but what springs to mind first as initial investigations, you know, really obvious things to rule out, does anything, what comes to mind for you?
So firstly, I have huge respect for you guys as clinicians who specialize in fatigue, because I think it is one of the hardest areas to help. With testing, I ask endless questions of the client to try and work out where the biggest bang for the buck is going to be. So I think fatigue is a bit like a lasagna. There's just layers and layers and layers of stuff that's going to be contributing to this person's fatigue. It's very rarely one thing in isolation. So I have endless questions like, what's your diet like? And depending on how that question's answered, that would be an area that I might go and explore. For female clients, you know, are you losing a lot of blood on a monthly basis? Could that be an area that needs to be explored? Have they been carb loading for years and years? And could they be, you know, pushing towards insulin resistance and diabetes? And that would be something I would explore. So, some of these things are medical. They should be assessed by the NHS first. And I think that's probably where, for you guys, most of your assessments will have been done. And if they haven't been, I think sending someone to a GP for just a blanket screen of the basic test for thyroid, anemia, just a functional, you know, full blood chemistry, insulin, possibly in possible diabetes, looking at something like inflammatory markers as well, that's helpful. And depending on their gut health and things, could there be something like celiac that needs to be tested, just as a kind of initial starting point medically? Then when they've had all that done, there might be things within that that you might want to explore further. So if their TSH is a little bit higher than you might want to see optimally, but it hasn't actually been diagnosed outside of the NHS wider parameters, then you might want to do a full thyroid test. If they are frantically stressed out and haven't slept for months, or sleep is a major problem. Actually, sleep is one of the big areas. I'm sure you've got people talking about sleep on this conference, but sleep is one of the huge areas that I ask questions about. Quality, time, you know, are they type 1, type 2 insomniac? So that would be an area to think about, and you might want to think about adding melatonin into a test, or looking at their adrenal or so cortisol, DHEA, and also their neurotransmitter path. So are they tired and wired? That would be another area. Then I also think about toxic burden, oxidative stress, their poor little mitochondria, how are they functioning?
How are they doing in all of this? I mean, with going into sort of sleep, because that's an area that we like to kind of work with first, after sort of digestion, with sleep, it's so key to someone recharging and breaking down their stress hormones. There's a whole cycle there with that. What are your sort of favorite tests around something like adrenal functioning? I think the old school way of calling that sort of fatigue would be adrenal fatigue or adrenal burnout, which some people actually really relate to. And then you get into that whole tired but wired. So they're very sort of adrenalized and wired, but they're absolutely exhausted at the same time, sort of running on nothing. So what sort of testing do you think did you like to use for that?
So my favorite probably is the Dutch test, which stands for dried urine test for comprehensive hormones. It might be complete hormones. I should definitely know that.
But we'll let you off. I mean, this is a great one to use, I guess, in this current pandemic where we're not having access to blood draws and phlebotomy, and it's a kind of really easy to do at home, very hard to get wrong.
And it's looking at sex hormones, stress hormones, and some neurotransmitter markers or kind of organic acids, which I'll expand on in a second if you would like me to. But so from, I think for male and female clients, sex hormones can really help undermine your energy and your drive. So that's a useful piece of the puzzle to look at. Alongside
people who have kind of fatigue around their cycles, that just reminded me, we do, that's a question we definitely ask. Are you more tired? Are your symptoms worse? Is your fatigue worse after your or around your menstrual cycle? So it's a great,
there's tons of information that you can get from those kind of questions. But also in men, you know, low testosterone is a huge thing for the drive and oomph that can be missing. And can make you feel more tired and apathetic, I think. So sex hormones. Then within the same test, it's looking at cortisol, cortisone, and DHEA, which are your adrenal hormones. And a proper rhythm with those hormones is what really helps you get out of bed and function properly. So if that is off, it's called the cortisol awakening response. So within 30 minutes of waking, you should have your highest cortisol of the day, and then that should drop off appropriately throughout the day. And if that's not really happening, if you get a kind of flat line, then it affects your va-va-voom. There's nothing, there's nothing in the tank there. So that's an important assessment. Then alongside that, they also look at your organic acids. And there's only a handful of organic acids, because you can really go into depth into those, and we'll probably talk about those in a second, I would think. But within the Dutch test, they're looking at B12, which can be very important for energy and anemia, essentially. B6, which can be very helpful for things associated with energy production, for sure. It gives you a bit of information about methylation, which is, I think, useful to think about for energy, but it probably wouldn't be the first place I'd go for fatigue. But it's, there's so many nutrients involved in it that I think it's really important to get the nutrients right, and then methylation should catch up. But you can get really drawn into
methylation itself. Mean, Dr. Cara Fitzgerald actually talking about methylation and fatigue.
But
it'll be interesting, because a lot of people might be thinking of a test like this. When we think of methylation, we're often thinking of genetics and looking at someone's genetic SNPs or polymorphisms. But I find something like the Dutch test so great, because it shows the metabolomics, so what the actual end products are. So amazing test to actually show what's going on, rather than what's the potential or what's potentially could happen.
And also it gives you a possible why.
So if
you know, if you're missing some of the nutrients that you really need for that pathway, then that's helpful. And obviously it could be things that we're not looking at, like genetics, but so B6, B12 information. Then also fitting in nicely with that methylation part, it looks at the breakdown products of a couple of neurotransmitters. So dopamine, adrenaline, and noradrenaline are the end metabolites. And you can't get to those end metabolites if you can't methylate. So it's a very specific pathway that helps to clear those. So if you're looking at the result and this person is really hardwired for stress, and you know that they, on questioning, that they, you know, if they nearly get hit by a car when they're crossing the road, they will feel wired and edgy and anxious all day. Whereas the person next to them would have the same stress response to get them out of the road, but that just burns through, and they don't, you know, they don't feel on edge for the whole day. And that in itself, as questioning, is quite useful. You know, are you someone who is very wired after a stressful experience? Because if you can't, if you have a surge of adrenaline, then you can't get rid of it, you can't break it down, you are going to feel more like all day. And then,
and
that is
sleep, I guess, that the knock-on effect.
Exactly.
I guess an interesting question that I ask clients is understanding that caffeine uses that same pathway to be deactivated. So often people are having a cup of coffee in the morning and they're still feeling the effects of it in the evening, or affect their sleep. So that some people just naturally, genetically more sort of program, yeah, to clear caffeine more slowly. So that's another interesting clue, I find. That test just answers that question for us.
Yeah, it's really
nice, isn't it?
Yeah. So sometimes you can see from the results that actually this person, well, maybe this person is not breaking this down, and that's having that kind of knock-on effect. Mm-hmm. And then we also get a marker for melatonin in that test. So again, gives you an idea, can this person make enough melatonin to sustain really good quality sleep? Yeah. And often, and I don't know if it's the UK market or the people that we're seeing, but often there's so few people who make really, really good melatonin.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So that's helpful. And also in the Dutch test, not that this is a push for the Dutch test, but you get a marker for oxidative stress, looking at oxidative stress to DNA. And if that is elevated or even nearly elevated, that's a big problem. It gives you an idea that there's free radical damage going on in this person. And if you get free radicals anywhere near your mitochondria, then you're going to get some more information about why they might not be making really good energy.
Yeah, so much information comes off this test. And I guess another marker that it has is a glutathione marker, which is primary antioxidant for immune function, for energy production, for detoxification. And when that's really challenged, it could be a sign of toxic stress as well. So the test is great for sort of really understanding so many aspects. And we're often working off one test for months and months, which makes it really good value. For clients about this sort of test.
I think so. And I think, so if I was the clinician thinking about fatigue, I almost think of it like that I'm standing in the middle of a clock. So I've got to work round and see all of these different little areas that we might need to cover. And quite a big section of that clock is going to be stuff that's covered in the Dutch test.
Yeah, brilliant. And I guess going into a bit more detail around cortisol and the adrenal hormones, obviously, like, one thing I think of is looking at cortisol and melatonin together. You normally have this diurnal rhythm, or it literally tells your body what time of day it is. You know, your brain can sort of wake up in a different country after a really long flight and just know immediately it's 9 a.m. But how does your body know to do daytime things and nighttime things at certain time? So I guess when you see something like flatline cortisol and lack of spike in the morning, that suggests someone can't get out of bed in the morning, that becomes that sort of one type of problem. Are there any other sort of unusual abnormalities that you might see on a cortisol rhythm test?
So a lack of spike is one problem, but you could have excess cortisol. So someone who is making too much. And we're historically to blame, I think, as an institution or as a area of health, for pushing this adrenal fatigue, adrenal exhaustion thing. But we know that it's not that the adrenals stop working. It's not like the menopause where the ovaries decline in function. What happens is the communication from the brain. So whenever you're looking at adrenal result, be it a saliva one, of which there are plenty of great ones as well, or the dried urine one, what you're really looking at is, what is my brain telling my adrenals to do right now? They don't work on their own. They can't function without the signaling from up here. So if you are hardwired for stress, which unfortunately, because of trauma or some kind of adverse child events or things, which I'm sure you're covering in this series, your brain does not perceive the world to be a safe place. So, and that could be physical, psychological, or physiological. So your brain is telling your adrenals, this is not good. We've got to make tons of cortisol to survive.
Yeah.
And so tons of cortisol is produced. And again, that is not a safe environment for you to fall asleep in. So if your brain is saying, then it's not going to think, oh, great, it's dark now, I can really relax and go to sleep.
And digest, so all of that, kind of, it has knock-on effect on every system of the body, I guess.
And every gene, every cell, I think, has a clock gene. So, you know, this rhythm is really important. And how you navigate that is very difficult. So too much cortisol, it's the Goldilocks rule, right? Too much cortisol is a bad thing. It can be very helpful to have times when you have lots of cortisol for a a period of chronic stress, or if you've got an inflammatory condition, your body's desperately trying to put out the fire of that inflammation. But you want it for a short acute phase, not as a kind of chronic state. So too much is a bad thing, and not enough equally is a bad thing, and they can both make you feel equally rough.
Yeah, and actually, funnily enough, I was about to ask you what sort of person looks like they have a high cortisol, but actually I think more and more in clinic we're seeing it's quite confusing. Actually, the people that I thought had a flatline sort of circadian rhythm actually turned out to have really high cortisol and cortisone. So it's quite important, I think, to really understand before you go in, particularly with biological agents or herbs and nutrients. We see some people have quite adverse reactions to things that we think are quite safe and benign. I think you can never go wrong with the things like meditation, breathing, vagus nerve work, because it will always sort of benefit in each sort of scenario of cortisol.
Definitely learned the hard way when I branched out as a newly fledgling nutritional therapist. There were two things that were actually really useful as learning points. One was somebody came to see me with fatigue, and I was obsessed with adrenals. I was like, you need to do this adrenal test. This is going to cost you, £80 or something. Mm-hmm. This is what you do. Gave her all the instructions. And I said, but you should also go to the GP and get some bloods. And she went to the GP and she was just flat out anemic.
And then I felt
bad for saying, well, I was pleased I'd told her to go to the doctor firstly, but I felt bad that I'd been kind of on this thing of like, this is the thing that's going to be causing. So that's why I'm always like, doctor first, and then let's rule out anything awful. And then equally, I have given someone, I think I'm the only ever nutritionist who ever says they've done anything wrong, particularly on seminars, but I've made people feel not very well from giving them supplements that are too strong. And what is interesting about the Dutch test, and this is kind of possibly going a little too deep, but they measure the free hormone and the metabolized hormone. And in saliva, you're only getting the free hormones. This was many years ago when I was only doing saliva testing. And the free hormone can look pretty flat, and you're like, oh God, this person has got old school language adrenal fatigue. I need to really help them, stimulate them. And sometimes you get this pattern where that looks flat, but the metabolized cortisol, there is tons of it. So by giving them something that's possibly slightly stimulatory, you are exacerbating that and making them feel even more stimulated.
So it's the body trying to put the brakes on the person by sort of withholding, is that the right word, or kind of storing the cortisol for a real life sort of emergency, and by pushing them a bit more, you're actually potentially pushing them into worsening of their symptoms.
Or it's not that they can't make it, it's just that they're metabolizing it incredibly quickly. And so you're giving them something to make more, and it's like making them more stimulated. So I'm with you. I've backed off from, I would always test, don't guess. I think the Dutch test gives you another little piece of the puzzle that you're probably not getting from just a saliva test, but that's okay. The saliva test on its own is I'm not against it at all. I just think you need to bear in mind that there's possibly more to this picture that you're not fully seeing. And in the interim, do things that can support you either way, whether you're slightly upregulated or slightly struggling.
Yeah, brilliant. And we sort of touched on organic acids, and I know one of my favorite tests is the organic acids urine test. Again, another really convenient test to do. You can do it with children. I think the only restriction is that you sort of need to restrict water intake. So for some people with POTS or peeing in the night constantly, it can be quite hard to collect that sample. But I mean, going into that test a little bit, it covers so many bases, which I'm sure you'll sort of expand on. But firstly, what actually is an organic acid?
I know. The organic acid, when you're a clinician, when you do your first one, you get this thing where it's just like pages and pages of words that are completely unpronounceable and you want to just go, ah. So organic acids are very similar in structure to amino acids, but without the amine group. And they are formed by us as humans in all of our metabolic processes. So the fact that we are able to get up in the morning and function full stop is an actual miracle. If you begin to understand all of the enzymes and little things that have to go on inside every tiny cell of our body to get us to function, I mean, it is an actual miracle. We are the most sophisticated machines ever.
Yeah, we should congratulate ourselves on getting out of bed in the morning. Absolutely. It's the most special thing you can do. I like to tell my clients that.
Quite. And then we're kind of upset when we push and push and push and push and push, and then eventually our body goes, oh God, I can't do that anymore. But as part of all of these metabolic processes, we make things, and organic acids are essentially part of those metabolic processes. Mm-hmm. And there are tons of them, which are measurable by incredibly sophisticated machinery from, as you said, a first morning urine sample. And what it does is it gives you, as a test, the organic acid test, it gives you a little tiny window into lots and lots of areas. So when you, as a clinician, when you look at it, you're like, but each section has a title. So it'll tell you this bit is all from intestinal microbial overgrowth. So that page, that particular section, are from yeast, fungal, bacterial waste products, essentially. Mm-hmm. So those are actually things that we don't make ourselves. Those are things that if we've got them in high levels are most likely going to be coming from a dysbiotic picture within the microbiome. Mm-hmm. Some people say specifically to the small intestine. I personally don't put all of my weight into that argument. I think it could be from any kind of microbial imbalance. So if you've got mm-hmm. athlete's foot or vaginal thrush or some kind of topical skin issue, all of that has to make
UTI as well. I've seen people, I've used it with people with kind of really recurrent UTIs, and we found imbalances there too. So
And you know, if you've got a broken microbiome anywhere, it's going to have metabolic waste. It's got to get out of you somehow. So so it looks at a little window into the gut. Then, so cleverly, it looks at the metabolites that are made in the Krebs cycle. So from within your mitochondria, how you actually make energy, which is a very sophisticated cycle. Mm. And at each point, if that wheel can't turn, then you will get a buildup of certain organic acids. Mm. And then that gives you an idea as to why. So if the wheel can't turn, it might be that there's a nutrient missing that needs to be replaced. You add in the nutrient and then the wheel can turn. It might be that there's a toxin or something that's blocking that wheel. So then you might need to do further testing to establish what that is. It might be that you're simply not eating enough. So we see people, for example, on keto diets where they're just, particularly women who are not eating enough carbohydrate, and yet they and their cellular function is not good enough to be able to get what they need for the Krebs cycle to turn. It also looks at some neurotransmitter markers. So the same ones that we talked about in the Dutch test, those adrenaline, noradrenaline, dopamine markers, and also nicely some tryptophan markers, which gives you lots of information about why you might not be able to sleep or for melatonin. Then looks at some ketone markers. So if you are on a keto diet, you know, is that what you're now fundamentally functioning on? And then for me, the kind of most interesting bit, I think, is these nutritional markers. So there are two ways of looking at nutritional markers. So there's, as an example, a marker called methylmalonic acid, which is, again, is also done in the Dutch test. And it's a cellular marker. It gives you an idea of the cellular need for B12. So if you've got high levels of methylmalonic acid coming up, it needs B12 as a cofactor to turn into something else. So if you haven't got enough B12, then the methylmalonic acid will go up and up and up and up and up and up until you give B12, and then it will start coming down. So you want to have normal levels, like low, if anything, levels of methylmalonic acid.
And there's sometimes a couple. Sometimes you have actually normal B12 on a blood test. I've actually seen that too. And it's just the demand of B12 in the body is so high that organic acid can be elevated. So
that they haven't got the right form in their blood, or that there's other cofactors that mean they can't get it into the cell. It's hard, I think, that's quite common that you can have a high B12 or normal B12 in blood and yet have a cellular like screaming. Your cells going, I need more. So there's these ones where if they're high, that's a bad thing. And then there's other ones that are more of a direct measure for that nutrient. So if it's low, then that nutrient is actually low, like vitamin C or B6 or B5. They're actually being measured in urine. So if they're low in urine, then you need to add that in. Yeah. It gives you some ideas about detox, an indication for vitamin D, but you would need to go on to test vitamin D specifically. So I think in fatigue, where you've got all these possible layers of the lasagna that might be contributing towards someone, this is a nice way of looking at a few different areas of that to see where some kind of gross imbalances might be and why.
Yeah, it's a great test. And I know you can run a short version of the microbial, which a lot of people do as follow-up testing. One of the markers I really like on the OATS test is oxalates, because I find it's really interesting when you get to certain conditions like autism. There are specific patterns that we can often pick up on that. But oxalates, people with joint pains and I think those compounds themselves can block Krebs cycle, can't they? So it's another useful.
Yeah, so they're also sort of sticky molecules. Mm. So they combine toxins, so it can give you an idea of toxin issues. They're really compatible with yeast markers. They'll hang out like buddies. So if your yeast markers are high, then your oxalates can be as well. But depending on where they're deposited, they're like in my head, they're like grains of sand. But so depending on where they're deposited in tissue will be a different form of pain. So you can get them from the eyes or in the urine tract or, in joints or things like that. So it's another nice thing. Sometimes some tests will make you need to go off and do other tests, further testing. And sometimes you get enough information to understand from this test alone, actually these two are probably causing that. Let's go and deal with that.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much information. I know a few speakers on the conference are talking about mycotoxins and mold toxicity, and I guess it's not really because we do a whole separate mycotoxin urine test, but I think a few of the markers as well on the organic acids test can indicate some sort of colonization. So one of the questions I think people that work with mold would ask is it from an external building, water damaged building, or is there actually colonization in my body? So I think a few of the markers on the OATS test might be able to indicate Aspergillus or Fusarium, those species. So again, hugely useful, with the neurotransmitters in there as well, and serotonin markers really really interesting too. So again, another really useful test. So when something like when everything's wrong on an OATS test, which I have seen before, as well as the opposite where everything's right and you're concerned as why the person's feeling so well when metabolically look good. What's your priority? Where do you start working? Do you go in for digestion and the microbial balance, or sort of some of the raw materials for energy cellular production? I know there's no sort of right answer for this. Just jumping in and breaking that cycle.
It slightly depends. So if your gut is shot to pieces, and therefore you're not getting the best out of your wonderful diet that you're now eating that's full of colour and diversity and nutrition and everything you want, then really there's no point doing anything other than trying to sort out the gut and the digestion as a starting point, because until you can get more out of your food and your supplements.
Yeah.
But it's kind of synergistic. Your gut involves so much energy in its own work that you need to get the nutrients up as well. So it's not that you would necessarily hold fire on all of those vitamins. I'm only going to deal with the gut. You kind of have to do them slightly synergistically, I think.
Yeah.
And it depends how vulnerable people are. Some people, you know, they could have a terrible yeast or bacterial dysbiotic situation, but they're not going to be well enough to deal with antimicrobials yet. So you might have to support them more nutritionally, build them up, so that they are able to cope better with some of the die-off that these things can
release. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess particularly things like anemia, low ferritin, even magnesium, zinc, when we look at I know some of the blood tests look at intra and extracellular magnesium, and they're getting magnesium into the body sometimes, but they're not actually getting it into the cell. And then sometimes you're not absorbing your iron. What sort of things do you start to think of when someone's supplementing, they're taking quite expensive supplements, and then their blood tests or their, oats tests aren't actually getting better? What do you think of?
So I would be very suspicious about absorption. Dysbiosis is something else getting to your food, your nutrients, before you are. Particularly with iron, you can have different bacteria that can sequester iron for their own fortification. And so I think about infection. I would also think about something like celiac. So if the gut again is shot to pieces, are you not able to absorb all of these wonderful things that you're eating and taking? I would think about SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, for the same reason as celiac, really. Different, it's not damaging the infrastructure to your guts as such, and like celiac, but it might be preventing the absorption. So I think about digestion. So I'm obsessed about digestion from the top down. So chewing.
Just basic sometimes. And
yeah.
Acid and the effect that stress can have on suppressing your secretions as well.
Exactly. So hydrochloric acid, digestive enzymes. So in a stool test, for example, you can look at something like pancreatic elastase. I know there are genetic combinations that can mean that you might not be able to make as much of your pancreatic elastase as some people do. So all of those sorts of things would be my primary things, unless there's a reason. As I said, like if someone's got very heavy periods and they're bleeding an awful lot, that might be why you can't get their iron up sufficiently. But otherwise, I'm always suspicious about why someone is anemic, full stop. Why are you
And I guess the opposite with viral, acute viral infection, we're seeing high ferritin as well. It's quite a useful marker, I think, just assessing where the person's at and whether they're in acute state or chronic state of fatigue. Thinking about digestion and absorption in particular, you sort of touched on celiac and other SIBO, which can obviously, because of just the nature of them and they're quite inflammatory, that there can be sort of gut damage to them, or damage to the gut mucosa there. And you know, what we'll be touching on in immune system and some investigations there, so much of it we think of in the gut. What sort of tests are there to look at the gut barrier, or are there any markers in stool tests that we might be able to utilize as well?
So in stool, I would think about secretory IgA, which is one of your protective markers. So are you able to defend yourself against problems in the gut? That would be one of my first things. Short-chain fatty acids are also in a stool test, which are wonderfully protective products from bacteria. When you're eating good fibers, you need good fiber in the diet and good bacteria to kind of get the right balance of short-chain fatty acids. They're protective in the gut. They're protective for the brain. There's also work in them on the liver, for things like non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and adipose tissue and all sorts of things. They're wonderful. So those sorts of things. There are ways of assessing things like intestinal permeability. You can do that with, that's not done from a stool test, but there is a marker called zonulin. It's not my favorite marker in stool, but you can do that in serum. And you can also look at other drivers or kind of immune related dysfunction. So things in Cyrex, which is a specific in autoimmune really, is a blood test to look at things that might be affecting barrier permeability. So lipopolysaccharides, antibodies to the proteins that hold your gut together. So including zonulin and something called actomyosin, which is essentially the skeleton of your cells.
I guess what we're referring to is what used to be called leaky gut, and I guess we don't call it that anymore, but it's that hyperpermeability of the gut membrane. But I guess one of the questions clients always ask is, well, if my gut's permeable, why am I not absorbing all of my nutrients and my the vitamins just floating through nicely into the bloodstream? Why have I got nutritional deficiencies but lots of waste and garbage and kind of viral or bacterial proteins floating into the bloodstream? Is there what's the sort of your answer to that sort of question?
Well, you need it's a great question, actually. I've never really thought about it like that, but you need to be able to get the good out of your food and absorb it and keep the bad. It's not necessarily all bad, but you need to keep certain things in the lumen of your gut. So if you have got a broken window and some possums have broken into your house and they're just leaving garbage all over the place, you know, and destroying everything, you're just left with a kind of trail of destruction. So it doesn't matter that the house looked nice before they broke in, you know. It's so it's more about, it's a filter really, I guess. So this very sophisticated system that we have within our gut that is protecting us on, we have lots and lots of layers before we get anywhere near the cellular breakdown. And it's so sophisticated, and I don't think we give it enough credit really. But there, it's essentially a super sieve. So it's allowing the good guys in, but keeping the other stuff out. And there is so much bacterial debris that's going on in our guts. We want to keep it in our guts. As soon as that becomes introduced to our immune system, so if we have things called gram-negative bacteria, but if they are presented to the immune system, that is dangerous. So our innate immune system, our immune system that doesn't have to think, we're just born with it, is designed to protect us, violently protect us against this presentation of bacteria into our system. So if that's going on, it's very, very pro-inflammatory. The end stage of that is sepsis, which can kill you. And I'm not saying it's anywhere near that. But even a little bit of low-grade lipopolysaccharides being produced to the immune system is very pro-inflammatory. And we know that the immune system is energetically very draining.
Yes, absolutely. I think from one of the papers I read, it says a chronically inflamed immune system uses 2,000 kilojoules of calories a day, which is 500 to 700 calories. And the way I kind of talk to my patients about inflammation is, imagine you have to get onto a treadmill and try and burn off 500 calories. Like, how long would that take you? That's the amount of energy you're losing to the immune system just chronically being this low grade inflamed. So it's a huge incentive to kind of find out if that's an issue for someone. And I guess
I didn't realize it was that much.
It's shocking. Once you know that, you kind of know that. And it's not like you can eat two Mars bars and get that those calories back. You have to then turn it, your cells, your Krebs cycle, your mitochondria have to turn it back into ATP energy. So yeah, it's really interesting. And I guess so much kind of leading a little bit into immune system inflammation. You sort of mentioned the Cyrex test can actually detect lipopolysaccharides or antibodies to lipopolysaccharides. And we find with LPS, it's a really interesting indicator of brain fog and joint inflammation, and as well as an autoimmune driver. So I guess with things like our immune function, because so much of our energy is triaged into that, and we're looking at conditions like sort of long COVID now, we're thinking of all those sort of, I guess people are trying to think of how to protect themselves from potentially having something like long COVID. So what, I know it's a bit of a complex question, but we know, you know, things like high cortisol, for example, will like more likely lead you into a more severe prolonged illness, or just, you know, kind of slow down that recovery. And also inflammation, just a low or a high baseline inflammation can also lead to more severe, longer types of COVID. So what sort of inflammatory markers do you like to, or do you find useful to measure? I know the NHS sort of uses CRP, but we don't find as sensitive as we'd like to. It seems to work in acute infection, but then when thinking of longer low-grade inflammation, it's usually within range, frustratingly. From a lab point of view, what sort of
I haven't actually looked into this specifically to long COVID, and I probably should. We do work with an extraordinary German lab called Lab for More, and I don't know if you ever read scientific papers and you're like, wow, they can measure all this stuff, interleukin 10 and TNF-alpha and all this stuff. And you're like, I wonder who would do that commercially. This German lab.
Amazing.
So it may be that there are panels there that are worth looking at, because they are going to be looking so much more in depth at the inflammatory cytokines that could be driving some of these things. Mm-hmm. I haven't looked into that properly yet, but actually maybe we should, and see if they've got anything that they would recommend. I think that's kind of probably the most sophisticated. I think what I've seen in the cases of long COVID that I've talked about, I haven't seen any clinically, I'm not in clinical practice right now. I feel like it is highlighting people's vulnerability. So before they were ill, there was something that wasn't quite working right, or that was just, you know, under the threshold. They were driving along with their engine light on, saying there's a warning, and they're just ignoring the engine light. And COVID has struck them at the place where possibly they're most vulnerable. Again, the kind of layers of lasagna of fatigue, I think it could be a bit of everything, you know, tons of stress hormones, really bad blood sugar balance, not that they're diabetic, but that they have just not been working on that as a primary area, I guess.
The boatload, I guess, of lots of small kind of cogs working together to either produce illness or disease.
Exactly.
I mean, did you find things like essential fatty, do you do essential fatty acid testing, for example, balance of omega-3?
Yeah, we do. So we have a finger prick test for essential fatty acids, which I think is a really nice starting place. So it looks at omega-3s, omega-6s, saturated fats, and some omega-9 fats. And you don't want to be too dominant in saturated omega-6s. You want to have a really good balance with your omega-3s. And generally in Western society, we're too much omega-6 over omega-3s. So that would be an interesting area to explore. It's always interesting in immune, autoimmune, and inflammatory conditions. So yeah, that would be a nice area to take into consideration. I wouldn't necessarily use that as a marker of inflammation as such, but I think it gives you an idea about what's potentially happening.
Yeah, contributing to the ongoing
inflammatory, exactly.
Inflammation, yeah. And I mean, what are your thoughts on vitamin D? Because I know a lot of practitioners or doctors even just prescribe it now, because we're living in England, and you know, a lot of places don't get any sunshine above a certain latitude. But do you And then you have the other school of practitioners that will always test because it is a pro-hormone. So where do you sit on that in terms of vitamin D? It's always nice to get it from the GP. But do you think we should be measuring it sort of quarterly or biannually?
I think biannually would be great. But if you're going to give anyone super physiological doses, then test before and test to see how they're getting on. Mm. You can give very high doses and it barely shifts the needle, and that's possibly because they're just full of inflammation and it's just having a big effect on their ability to increase their vitamin D. But you can also get people who are very sensitive and are able to absorb it and top up their levels quite quickly, and you don't want to overdo it.
Yeah.
So if you are going too high, not too high, but if you're getting into the tens of thousands supplemental wise, then you need to monitor that regularly. Mm-hmm. If you're going for the NHS dose is too small, I think, to worry about testing on a regular basis.
Yeah, it's about 1,000 IU.
Yeah. So I don't think that needs to be monitored on a particular regular basis. But if you're going up much, you know, really off-label high dose, then that really should be monitored, and it's not expensive to do. We have a finger prick test that's about £40 on its own. There's also some other, well, we've also now got a little microtainer thyroid test that does CRP and ferritin and vitamin D and B12, all of the things we've just talked about.
Yeah, that's and a great sort of starter, isn't it, for someone who's just slightly concerned about fatigue and sort of wants to open the door gently.
And that's, I think, about £80. So again, you're not it's not cost prohibitive to start. Well, that's all relative, I know, but if you're going to be putting someone on high doses, I think you want to know where they were before you start. Yeah. Then you can work out what dose to give them as is appropriate, and then see if that is going up as you want it to, and then back off.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess there's such thing as too much vitamin D, which can then liberate all your minerals. So what sort of ranges do you like with vitamin D? I think we tend to not go over 150 nanomoles, but we like it around 90 as the ideal.
Yeah. So I'd say 100 to 150 is okay. You're getting towards 200, you're going too far.
Yeah, too much of a good thing for bad things.
Goldilocks again.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess when we're thinking of kind of load on the immune system, something that comes up, and I used to use it a lot more in clinical practice, now not so much, but sort of food inflammation and potential, you know, we touched on celiac, which is sort of different mechanism to food intolerance. But you know, when someone is reacting to their diet or allergies and to the environment or intolerance to chemicals, that can be really informative as to, you know, what to actually exclude. So it's not just about putting loads of new things in. Sometimes just avoiding things that are a drain on your energy.
Well, stuff like histamine, if you are creating a lot of histamine for one reason or another, that is an exhausting chemical to have loads of.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
it also wakes you up in the night, so it's a double whammy of really sleep. But
So we have a little finger prick test done by an American lab called KBMO. It's called the FIT test, food inflammation test. Mm-hmm. And you can do a panel with 22 foods, or you can do a much broader panel of 100 and something foods. But it's just a finger prick looking at IgG antibodies bound to complement, which again is a pro-inflammatory marker. So it's preferable to me, this test, because it's getting much more into the specifics about inflammation. And if you are having endless food reactions, then obviously we need to look at the reason why that is. But as we said, that can be pretty tiring. So that would be another thing to rule out.
Yeah, definitely a useful, I think, clinical tool, because I think when people are some people have quite complex fatigue, so it's really hard to know where to start with them. And something like that can be a huge change that they are in control of, and they can very quickly, when excluding and eating the right foods for their bodies, they can huge improvement in a short amount of time. So it's a nice win as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And it's nice that that particular test doesn't come up with 30 or 40 things for them to cut out. It will cut out. It's the ones that I've reviewed which I've reviewed many, but they seem to be more selective, so it's not too overwhelming for people to have to cut out.
Yeah. So it's also disheartening when 40 foods come up and you think, what can they actually eat? So yeah, that's really good to use. So I think, I mean, there was so much information that we've sort of discussed. I think it looks like I can imagine my clients thinking, I'll need all of these tests. But we can only start with one thing at a time. And often when we're running these tests, a lot of them have months of sort of information to work with. So I think it's important to sort of remember that too. Thanks, Laura. That's I think we'll sort of leave it at that, because we could go on and on and talk about gut, and that's a whole other conversation, isn't it? But for people who'd like to find out more, I guess, about your work with the AFMNP, and also sort of more information about lab testing that might be suitable to them, where could you point them to?
So from a lab point of view, I work for Regenerous Laboratories. And so if you go to regenerouslabs.com, that's where all of our testing is, all the funky German lab tests and the Dutch test and organic acids, all of those, stool testing, everything is all available there. From the AFMNP point of view, if you are a practitioner, we offer a mentoring program, which is, as you said, actually is largely based on community as well, but we do some teaching to really help take your teaching, which happens quite quickly in functional medicine often, even if you're a doctor or a nutritionist and you've been doing all of this for years and years and years, but when you get onto the kind of express train of functional medicine, there's often a bit of a gap between what happens in the classroom to what happens in clinical practice. So we're specializing in where the rubber meets the road, so in clinical practice, so just helping people build confidence. We teach in quite a specific way, and it, sometimes people, I think to start with, people are like, oh, well, I did all this in college, why would I need to do this again now? And it's much more practical advice than you were taught before. So so we're just trying to build confidence in clinical practice.
I think that's so important. I think new students, where they've learned all this theoretical information and suddenly they're faced with a patient and all of that theory does not match. You can do everything by the book, but sometimes it just doesn't gel with the patient. So I think it's so important to have that community, because it can be really isolating working on your own as a nutritional therapist, and learning from a community is amazing. So I thoroughly recommend that program.
Thank you. It's been a great project. We're really enjoying it. We get such wonderful feedback. We're very grateful for our little community that we've made.
Brilliant. No, thank you so much, Laura, for joining us today.
And it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.